Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Zoo and Wildlife Medicine, Molly Varga. Thank you, Molly. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. So what I would like to talk to you about today are lab samples. So we all know that for most of our patients, a clinical examination isn't going to be enough. And what I want to think about is actually how we make the most of what may be very tiny samples that we can obtain. So there are various things that I would like to think about going through. And I think the first thing is sample collection. So in terms of that, I'd like to go through that with regard to a variety of species. Then I want to talk a little bit about what some of these blood samples mean. And then I want to talk a little bit in terms of white blood cells, red blood cells, enzymes, metabolic products, that type of thing. And so that we actually get an idea of obtaining the sample, or handling the sample, evaluating the sample, whether that be at an external lab or in-house, and exactly what that means for our patients. So I think that these sorts of things are actually quite important, and they are the sorts of things that I think quite often get forgotten, particularly with some of the smaller and perhaps what might one might term less expensive species, except to say that actually quite often we can get really good and useful samples. They don't need to cost a lot. They don't need to necessarily be invasive, but there is certainly things that we can do that will then inform our treatment plans and potentially also things like our nursing care plans as well. So it's something that we certainly shouldn't forget about with our exotics patients. So I want to talk to begin with about blood sampling, and I would encourage everybody to be a lot more confident and potentially sort of definitely promote this more for a lot of our exotic patients, ideally earlier on in the course of the disease or the course of treatment, simply because actually quite often when we see exotics patients, we may not have the best idea of exactly what's going on, particularly those species that are very good at hiding their clinical signs. So having a little bit of an evidence base earlier on can be very useful indeed. And it doesn't mean that you have to spend a lot of money or necessarily get a large volume of blood, but it's certainly something that we should very much be considering, as I say, very early on in the course of any kind of treatment plan, if at all possible. So I think the first thing to say is that unlike dogs and cats, with respect in particular to birds and reptiles, we need to be very careful about the type of blood tube that we use. So in birds and reptiles, we would be primarily using a lithium heparin or an orange top blood tube. And this is because the EDTA tubes will very typically damage some of the cells that are present in the bloodstream. So, in terms of birds and reptiles, we would not be using EDTA tubes at all. Lithium heparin actually can be used for most tests, and if you're using an exotic specialized lab, then they're very used to just dealing with the one type of blood tube for the blood sample. So it becomes much less of an issue. And on that point, I would also highlight that actually using a lab, ideally that is specialised so that they've got the sort of technology that allows you to submit the ultra low volume samples, is very useful indeed. Many of the commercial labs don't have that technology. So again, it's worthwhile asking that question. For a lot of species, one of the secondary samples that we may wish to submit is serum. And in terms of that, that might be looking for things like antibody titers to diseases such as aspergillosis in birds or E. cuniculi or something like that in rabbits. And as far as that goes, again, what we would tend to want to do would be to ideally use either a plain tube or a serum gel tube and spin that down and submit that sample already separated. In very tiny animals or animals where you feel like the blood draw may take a very long time, then it is always worthwhile using heparinized syringes. But just to remember that a heparinized syringe will have a volume of heparin in it. So you may need to remove some of that if you're using a heparinized syringe for an exotic sample. For example, if the volume of the sample is going to likely be very, very small. And we need to really be very careful about the volume of the sample that we are likely to acquire. And as a good rule of thumb, for most animals, the maximum blood draw should be about 1% of the body weight, so up to 100, 1 mL per 100 grams. But you must remember that within that you need to include anticipated hemorrhage or hematoma. So you may well find that, for argument's sake, in something like a parrot or a tortoise, if you do a blood sample, then you can actually get quite significant hematoma that is probably a larger volume than your blood sample after the blood draw, unless you're very careful. The other thing to consider is how that animal is. For animals that are slightly shocky or are very fragile and frail, then the volume of blood you should take needs to be reduced. And you may want to take it down to perhaps half a mil per 100 grams for those animals that are really, really quite unwell. So as you can see, there's a lot to consider. The other thing that you may wish to be considering is whether you need a glucose evaluation. And again, that's certainly something that might be very important for things like rabbits, if they're in gut stasis, or may be very important for things like guinea pigs and degus, if you're concerned about things like diabetes. And if you're going to submit a blood glucose for evaluation at a lab, then you may well need to add a citrate sample in addition to your heparin sample, and that would actually be very usable for most exotics. Equally, as long as you use the same settings, you could certainly use an in-house glucometer. The absolute reading may not be useful, but the trend will be certainly useful. So again, that's another thing to consider. So what are we going to necessarily do? And I think that, as I said, with many of these animals, so for example, things like budgies, like cockatiels, like things like rats and mice and hamsters and degus and things like that, the blood sample volume that we're going to have is going to be small. So what we need to do is we need to think about how we maximize this. And what we may want to do is actually to do things like using capillary tubes to do a PCV, a packed cell volume, so a measurement of the percentage of red cells in the blood. We may want to look at how to do blood smears, and I will go into that in a moment. We may well need to decide which tests are going to be the most useful and plan to prioritize those. And if you stipulate the tests that you need, that's what the lab will tend to do first, rather than leaving it up perhaps to the lab themselves to decide which tests they're going to do on the limited sample that they have. I want to also make a point for a minute about in-house analyzers. Now, many of them these days do have reference ranges for a variety of species, and while they can certainly be very useful in urgent samples, the absolute values are not going to be as good on an in-house analyzer as they might be if you send samples out to an external lab. So it depends on the degree of urgency of the results and whether perhaps you want to do some things in-house, for example, like a blood glucose, and whether some things are going to be better placed externally. And you can wait for those results because you've got what you need immediately, and you can go on with stabilization and nursing care while we're waiting for everything else. In terms of the in-house analyzers, again, sometimes what we get an issue with is the volume that you're able to submit to them. And again, that might be certainly a limiting factor in the use of some of these blood machines. So you may wish to do that, for example, as I said, a glucometer for blood glucose. You may want to do a uric acid reading. You may want to do an ammonia reading, for argument's sake. All of the things that might be very needed very rapidly, you might want to just do a PCV and sort of assess the degree of anemia that you have present. But commercial labs are almost undoubtedly going to give us better and more reliable and repeatable results. So, absolutely, I've got no commercial interest in commercial labs other than the fact that I want the results that they give me. And I would highly recommend using a lab, as I said, with exotics and/or wildlife capabilities, because they are likely to be able to give you more for a much, much smaller sample. And they should be able to give you a range of biochemical tests. They should be able to directly give an accurate evaluation of the hematology. They can certainly look for things like toxins or suggest that you should be looking. And they can perform things like serology or DNA PCR analysis when we're looking for certain organisms within an individual or within a population. Other things that they can certainly do are things like DNA sexing. So, as far as external labs go, I would find one that you're comfortable with, understand what their submission requirements are, and certainly get used to using them if you can. And it's at all possible. Most of the external labs that we use these days, we get results within 24 hours. And as I say, other than the emergent cases where we do a small limited amount of things in-house, we would tend to use an external lab now for all of our samples. So, what are we going to do if we can only literally get a drop of blood? So this is where I think that using a microhematocrit tube and spinning it down becomes very, very useful. And if that is all we have got, then a microhematocrit tube usually is one or two drops of blood. So, essentially, literally a 20th of a mil of fluid. And if you have that tiny amount of blood, then I would certainly put it in a microhematocrit tube. Most of the microhematocrit tubes these days are already heparinized. Plug the tube and spin it down. And the information that gives you can be actually very, very useful. So you can get a direct PCV, and that is the measured percentage of red cells within the total blood volume. And that can be evaluated against published reference ranges, remembering that different species will have different reference ranges. And a lot of them are now available in things like Carpenter's Exotics Animal Formulary, the Exotics BSAVA manuals. So there's a lot of resources out there for you to be able to compare the results that you've generated with what should be normal for the species. But in addition to the PCV, you can get other bits and pieces of information. So if you have the capability of looking at urine-specific gravity, a lot of those specific gravity readers will also read total protein off the top of the plasma. So what one would tend to do is to then slightly break the microhematocrit tube, pop the drop of the plasma onto the urine-specific gravity reader, and then directly take a reading of the total protein levels. And even if it just gives you an absolute, this is really low or this is really high, then actually that can be really, really helpful. The other thing that you can do with a microhematocrit tube is a direct blood smear or ideally a buffy coat smear. Now, the buffy coat is the white layer that consists of white blood cells. You can usually visualize it on top of the red blood cell layer, and you can eyeball it and say, okay, that looks relatively normal. It should be less than 1% of the total. Or, man, that looks really, really thick. There seems to be a lot of white blood cells, and the levels are likely to be elevated. So even if it is quite a crude evaluation, that is more information than you had 10 minutes before. So I would absolutely encourage the use of any type of volume of blood sample that you can get, in order to sort of promote the knowledge of what's going on within your patients. So I mentioned blood smears, and I think that these are really, really useful to practice and get get used to becoming good at. And while external labs will certainly do these, they have to do them on usually the heparinized samples. So the sample quality will deteriorate a little. And if you can do a blood smear on whole blood at the time of sampling, then as long as you have a good blood smear technique, then you are likely to get better cell preservation, a better sample, and therefore better clinical results and more accurate clinical results. And as I say, I would absolutely go ahead and think about practicing these. The way that I do these is that I put a single drop of blood near the frosted end of a slide. I pick up a second slide, draw it backwards towards me into that drop of blood until the blood extends to each side of the slide, and then I push the second slide rapidly forwards. And what you want is quite a small drop of blood so that the slide that you're using to spread the sample isn't overwhelmed. You want a very even sample and ideally little enough blood that the edge of the sample stops before the edge of the slide, and you get what they call a feathered edge. And this is where a lot of the white blood cells will migrate to. And within a blood smear, obviously, at some stage, you will likely damage some of the cells that you're trying to preserve. However, I would still encourage you to not be put off doing this type of sample because it can be very useful. What you are looking to do is to have an even, thin blood smear that is thin enough that you can read a newspaper through it. And I think that that is something that is quite a good benchmark. A thick smear or one that is perhaps uneven is unlikely to give you such good results. But again, it's something that can be practiced fairly easily in-house. And even if you're going to evaluate the blood sample in-house, it can be very useful. And if you're doing a direct smear or doing a blood cell evaluation using a hemocytometer even, then it's a good comparator. And as I say, I would encourage people to really, really, really consider learning how to do that and practicing that kind of a skill. So, where are we going to think about getting blood from? I want to start with mammals simply because these are probably the most and the more familiar species. And I'm going to start with rabbits initially because I think this is probably the commonest and most familiar species that we think about in terms of blood sampling. So I have a picture here of a rabbit ear, and it's clipped to show all of the veins. With rabbit ears, what I would say is that if you're going to take blood from the ear, it's certainly very possible to get quite large volumes of blood from most rabbits' ears, but sometimes this does need to be done relatively slowly. So, in terms of rabbit ears, the sort of preparation that we would need to consider would be clipping the blood vessel, clipping above it, certainly getting it sort of reasonably surgically prepared. But actually, the other thing that I would highlight as a very useful addition to that is applying Emla cream. Now, Emla cream is a topical local anaesthetic cream. You put it over the ear vein that you are planning to sample, and if you pop a dressing over that, leave it for 20 minutes, it will almost numb the entire thickness of most rabbits' ears, which allows you to easily, in a non-stressful manner, get a good sample from most animals. Now, if we look at the picture of the rabbit's ear above, you can see very clearly that each edge of the ear, there are blood vessels, and there are blood vessels down the center. The big blood vessel in the center of the ear is an artery, and unless you have a requirement for arterial blood, then that should not be used for blood sampling. And blood sampling from that artery can result in quite serious damage and necrosis to the center of the ear. So if you're using ear veins, you want to look at the veins at the edges of the ear. And generally, the one that we would use the most commonly would be the vein at the caudal edge, so the edge of the ear that is towards the back of the animal. So in terms of that, what I tend to do is that one of my nurses will hold the rabbit and will occlude the blood vessel very close to the base of the ear once that ear has had the local anaesthetic applied. The local anaesthetic quite often will slightly dilate that blood vessel, and it allows you to visualize it more easily. Other things that you can do if the rabbit seems to have very small blood vessels is to very gently use warm, safe and warms, or lukewarm hot hands or something like that. Again, to just directly apply to the blood vessel to slightly dilate it. And if you're planning to try and get a large volume of blood out of an ear vein, then quite often it's very useful perhaps to place a catheter and to take the blood sample from that rather than just relying on a sample off the end of a needle. So that would be my top tip, certainly for rabbit ear veins. Jugular samples. So we get jugular samples actually from quite a lot of species. So most birds, excluding pigeons, have a very large and very accessible right jugular vein. The left-hand jugular vein in birds is relatively small, but many species of birds have a feather tract over the jugular area, meaning that there's a feather-free portion of skin that allows you to see the jugular and get a sample relatively easy. And this includes, quite small birds, for example, budgies and cockatiels, up to the much larger birds. So that can be quite useful. We tend to also use the jugular for ferret blood samples as well. And in terms of ferrets, one of the things that I'd like to highlight at this stage is that ferret skin is very thick and very dense, and it will drag on a needle. So for most blood samples, we try and say use the smallest needle that is consistent with getting a good blood sample. In ferrets, we may need to compromise and use a slightly larger needle simply because a slightly larger needle stays sharper longer and will get through the skin and also into the vein, whereas the very tiny needles perhaps won't do that. So jugular blood samples in ferrets are done very much in the same way as dogs and cats are. Other species where we take jugular blood samples can be some small species of gecko and also species such as tortoises. And if we think about tortoises for a moment, the jugular veins are visible usually on each side of the tortoise's neck, but instead of them being slightly towards the ventral portion of the neck. Tortoise jugulars are certainly higher up than you would expect if you were expecting something similar to a cat or a dog. And instead of being, for example, at 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock, as they would be in a dog or a cat, they're more like at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. So very much more dorsal on the neck and almost extending back from the ear scales. So again, that's a good tip for things such as tortoises. For smaller species, so things like guinea pigs, chinchillas, degus, hamsters, African pygmy hedgehogs, as we've got here, then it may not be very easy to use the jugular. And if the jugular is quite small, what you may not want to do is to damage it by blood sampling it if the needle size is going to be similar to the vein size. And it might be safer and more sensible to use a more central blood vessel. And this is where we go to the cranial vena cava. So this is a little bit more scary, and cranial vena cava samples require an anaesthetic, and it is an entry into a body cavity. So again, we need to be considering whether this is something appropriate to your training level in order to go ahead and do. What we tend to do with cranial vena cava blood samples is you find the top of the sternum. You can generally feel that at the base of the neck, and you drop off the side of that, and your needle enters the chest, and you direct it in a smooth line towards the opposite back leg. And you pop the needle in, you withdraw slightly, and you draw back. You never redirect the needle if you're in the chest. So you draw back slowly in a smooth line until you hit blood. And you perhaps don't repeat that more than once or twice if you need to get a really good sample. And it's something that is obviously a higher risk, but hopefully with a higher benefit. Other places that you can consider getting blood samples are some of the more familiar ones. So things like the cephalic vein, they are certainly accessible in rabbits, they're certainly accessible in guinea pigs sometimes, and certainly in ferrets. So again, the amount of blood you are likely to be able to get from the cephalic vein might be reduced compared to a dog or a cat sample, but it doesn't mean that you couldn't get something useful. Other blood vessels that are quite useful, the lateral saphenous vein. So we use that quite commonly in rabbits, and I would use that in preference to the ear vein in many cases, simply because actually I can get a bigger volume. It's away from the rabbit's head, it bothers the rabbit a lot less, and it just in general is a lot easier. But I would highlight with the saphenous vein the fact that actually it can be very easy to think that you're holding it off properly when in fact you haven't popped the vein up as much as we could do. And what we need to think of when you're using the lateral saphenous vein on the back leg of a rabbit is that you need to hold off that leg above the stifle or knee joint, and the pressure needs to be on the back of the leg, not on the side of the leg. And that is a key point. As soon as you put more pressure on the back of the leg, then that vein will pop up and become much, much larger and much more easy to visualize. And just as a note, when you're taking blood from that vein, it is very, very superficial, and it's very prone, certainly to hematoma formation. So again, to just be aware that after the blood sample is taken, you are certainly going to need to put some pressure on that area and potentially actually put a pressure bandage on there as well. So birds, as I say, we use the jugular quite often. The right jugular vein is massively useful. And in general, other than in pigeons that have rather several small veins than one large jugular, this would be my go-to site in most birds. other places that you can consider are things like the medial metatarsal vein. So that's the vein that runs on the inside of the leg below the hock. And things like waterfowl, chicken, that type of bird, and also actually quite a lot of species of parrots, that vein is big enough to pop in an IV catheter, and it's certainly big enough to get a good blood sample. I tend to be less enthused about using the basilic or the ulnar vein, so the veins on the medial side of the elbow, simply because actually these veins will blow very rapidly. Hematoma formation can be significant, and because of where they are, that if particularly if the sample is being taken conscious, if the bird flaps, then you can get a lot of blood going under the skin in that area very rapidly. So for me, it would not be my preferred area. And then reptiles. So we've mentioned that you can use the jugular in some species of reptiles. There are other places that we can consider. So in many lizards, the go-to vein would be the ventral tail vein or the ventral coccygeal vein. And this runs in the midline under the spine of the tail. You need to be very careful with those species, such as geckos, that will drop their tails. And I certainly would not use the ventral tail vein in geckos. I would tend to try the jugular. And what you tend to do is that you have the lizard in an upright or slightly dorsal recumbency. You prepare the ventral tail so that it's clean for a sample. You visually determine where the midline is. You put your needle in at a 45 degree angle, advance it until you hit the spine, and then withdraw very slightly. And 9 times out of 10, you will be in the right position to hit that blood vessel. Sometimes coming out slightly and going in a little bit more perpendicular to the vein can also help. In some species, there is also a very large ventral abdominal vein, and it's a continuation of the ventral coccygeal vein. It is quite large. It can be accessible for sampling, but it is very difficult to put pressure on it after sampling. So again, the risk of hematoma is real. For snakes, we tend to consider again the ventral coccygeal vein in those animals that are big enough for it to be usable. So that tends to be over sort of 200-300-ish grams. It can also be a little bit species dependent, and some species have a well-developed ventral tail vein, and some species certainly don't. With many snakes, the standard of care is the extremely scary heart blood sample. And these can be done conscious theoretically. However, my feeling is that if there is a possibility to safely sedate that animal, I think these samples hurt and I think they're risky. So sedation briefly to get a good blood sample is likely to be sensible. And when you do a heart blood sample, again, you can use, for argument's sake, your blood pressure Doppler to locate the heart. You can sometimes visualize it. You stabilize the heart and you do a single needle advance into the main ventricle, pull back very slowly and come out. You would never redirect your needle at that point. But again, because it's quite an invasive sample, this might be something that you're more likely to assist with rather than necessarily perform. I've mentioned the jugular in terms of chelonia, so tortoises and terrapins. Other places for these species would be the subcarpal sinus. So this is very similar to trying to access the ventral tail vein in lizards. It's a vein that goes under the spine, but this time we're looking at going under the spine inside the shell. So what you tend to do is you access that vein from the front of the tortoise. You again visually determine where the midline is. You clean and prep the skin at the margin of the shell and the neck. You may wish to pop to encourage the head inwards slightly, and you go in the midline with a needle that angles up, and you are aiming to touch the inside of the shell, which is where the midline of the spine will be. You touch the shell, and then you withdraw slightly, and again, generally, you will be in that blood vessel. Samples from this area can be prone to dilution with lymph, which can affect the results, but as long as you let the lab know, they should be able to deal with that. And then the other place in tortoises and terrapins would be the dorsal rather than the ventral tail vein. And it's accessed in very much the same way as you would the ventral tail vein. You find the midline visually, you insert the needle at 45 degrees, advance until you can feel bone, withdraw slightly, and then you should be in the vein. So, what about white blood cells? So, in many species, the white blood cell that is dominant is the neutrophil. So, in cats and dogs, the most numerous white cell would be the neutrophil. In a lot of our exotic species, so some species of bird, some species of reptile, and certainly things like rabbits, the dominant white blood cell is in fact the lymphocyte. So that is certainly something to be aware of when you're looking at blood smears. Quite often, with some of our exotic species, we call neutrophils in those species heterophils, and this is because of the staining characteristics of the cell, and they can be mistaken for eosinophils if you're used to only looking at cat and dog blood samples. The next thing to consider is that obviously in cats and dogs, if they have an infection or if there's severe inflammation, the white cell count goes up very rapidly. Actually, in exotics, sometimes it can be very hard. There must be a great deal of challenge to change the white cell count, the total white cell count. But what you might notice is a shift away from lymphocytes being dominant to having more heterophils. So the white cells in total may be about the same, but the balance of the type of cells may well shift. With a lot of these species, the more we find out about them, the more we know that a lot of the white cell parameters change with gender, they change with age, and they sometimes change with time of the day. There are some specific things that we recognize in some of our pet animals. So, for example, chinchillas, the neutrophils appear similar to those in dogs with Pelger-Hewitt anomaly, which means that you have neutrophils with a nucleus that appears not to have a normal amount of segments. It's hyposegmented. Guinea pigs, hamsters, and gerbils also have heterophils, really, rather than neutrophils. And they are more aligned with our rabbit patients. But other species of rodents, such as rats and mice, are more aligned with dogs and cats and have true neutrophils. In terms of a lot of these blood smears, one of the things that we will quite commonly, and possibly more commonly than in our dog and cat patients, see are monocytes. And monocytes are likely to be very much the largest white blood cells on your blood smear. And it's certainly a very useful thing to recognize because you'll certainly see them in birds, perhaps that have things like aspergillosis. You'll see them in reptiles that have chronic granulomatous disease, so perhaps chronic abscesses or something like that. And while they may look like very large and active lymphocytes, they're in fact a sign of very long-term inflammation. Red blood cells are more numerous in most blood samples than white blood cells, and they are equally important. We need to remember that with many of the species we're talking about, red blood cells are likely to have nuclei. So, bird and reptile red blood cells will have nuclei, which is why it's very difficult for us to use most in-house hematology machines to look at these samples. And this is why we need to come back to looking at the PCV. We need to come back to thinking about looking at blood smears in-house if we don't have the capacity to send samples out to the lab, simply because we just can't use the equipment that we have in the same way that we would, for example, for a rabbit or a cat or a dog. In many of our patients, particularly the prey species, by the time they are sick enough that it's noticeable, and that is not tending to imply that we're not good at this and that owners are poor, but they're just good at hiding illness. By the time these guys are sick enough to show that they're ill, we will often already have a low-grade regenerative or non-regenerative anemia. And in terms of that, it is not uncommon, and it's the sort of thing that gives us a little bit of a red flag, if there is nothing else going on. We know that something has gone on with that animals. And to just highlight that the sort of the measurement that we get in practice is a direct measurement. So the PCV is a measurement that we can visually see. The hematocrit, which is something that is calculated in the lab, can be a slightly different value, and it's calculated using the volume of the red blood cells that are evaluated. So, as I say, just to highlight that that is not necessarily a directly relatable thing. So let's think about some of the other things that we might be looking for in blood samples. And I want to highlight things like metabolic products. So the products are byproducts of digestion and sort of liver function and renal clearance. So we all know, and it's very familiar to have urea in some of our blood samples. We may think of that as a marker of kidney disease. We may think of it as a marker of hydration status. And certainly, urea in most species will be elevated where the kidneys are not clearing the blood sufficiently. And it will certainly be elevated in those animals that are dehydrated. If we think about animals that perhaps are less familiar, so if we're thinking about birds and reptiles, uric acid and not urea is the byproduct of eating protein. So in these species, in birds, we tend not to measure urea at all. And in reptiles, we would measure urea simply to give us an indication of chronic hydration status. So the emphasis has changed a little bit. In those animals that we see that are herbivores, so things like guinea pigs and rabbits, urea may be reduced because of the type of diet that animal is on. It's a low protein diet. Creatinine is always a good marker of renal blood flow. And again, we tend to look at that in most of our mammalian patients. We are less able to evaluate that in our bird patients, and we don't tend to evaluate it in reptile patients as significantly. The reason we have that kind of difference is that reptiles have quite primitive kidneys, mammals have quite evolved kidneys, and birds, dependent on the species, are a little bit of a halfway house, and the kidneys are half mammalian and half reptilian. And the amount of type of kidney tubules, as I say, varies with the species of birds. Bilirubin, again, we evaluate that in terms of liver function in a lot of our mammalian species. In birds, we would certainly be looking at different bile pigments. So biliverdin would be the bile pigment that we would look at in birds in terms of evaluating liver function. In all species, we look at bile acids, and again, we can say that they're elevated or they are depressed. And bile acids allow us to assess how efficiently blood is being moved around the liver and how efficiently bile is being moved around the liver. So how well that organ can function in order to sort of clarify the blood, if you like. Glucose, we've mentioned that in terms of evaluating that immediately, perhaps in rabbits. It can be elevated very easily in times of stress, and again, that can be species dependent. Rabbits with intestinal blockage tend to have very high blood glucose, although it is not a definitive test for a blocked intestine. And those animals that are septicemic will tend to have a very depressed blood glucose. Other metabolic products such as cholesterol and triglyceride are also commonly measured, in particular in things like birds. And we do have some species of birds, such as Amazon parrots, that will have issues with cholesterol that can cause heart disease. So, what about enzymes? Again, these are starting to be the very familiar ones that we look at in dogs and cats. And what we need to understand is the difference in emphasis. So, in a lot of the patients that we look at, we do not look at alanine aminotransferase or ALT. It is much less specific for the liver in most of the exotic species. So, actually, what we are more reliant on are things like aspartate aminotransferase or AST, and we find that in the liver as well as in skeletal muscle. We also look at alkaline phosphatase. Again, there is some liver specificity, and in conjunction with bile acids, a high ALKP may suggest that actually the bile is not flowing well around the liver. Creatinine kinase is fairly muscle specific in most species. So if we look at AST and we have a low creatinine kinase, then the likelihood is we have liver damage rather than muscle damage. But remembering that if we're struggling to get blood samples and we're struggling to restrain some of these animals, even blood sampling restraint will increase the creatinine kinase. Amylase levels can be very low in a lot of the exotic species. So these again can be more difficult to interpret. And amylase is usually removed from the blood by the kidney. So in terms of that, we may be looking at kidney disease rather than necessarily disease of the pancreas. Other liver parameters such as gamma glutamyl transferase and lactate dehydrogenase can be evaluated, and they may be relatively non-specific, and it can be quite variable in terms of which lab you use as to whether these are looked at. Serology. So this is where we are looking for the body's immune response to disease, and it can be quite commonly done in a lot of exotic species. There are a suite of tests available from most commercial labs, so tests certainly for rabbits, for various species of birds, and also certainly for reptiles. So if we're looking, for example, for mycoplasma in tortoises, psittacosis in parrots, E. cuniculi in rabbits, serology may well be something that is quite useful. It may well be also useful to take paired samples, and in terms of that, paired samples are likely to allow you to assess whether an animal is mounting an active immune response to a disease. However, for things like E. cuniculi, the paired samples are not useful because we know that the titers will vary anyway. Urinalysis. This is something that we are likely to be able to do very usefully, even during a consult period. The picture on this slide is courtesy of Greendale Laboratories, and this is a picture of five different vials of normal rabbit urine. All of these are within normal levels. So we know that the colour of the urine of many species can be very, very variable. So guinea pigs and rabbits certainly can excrete pigments in the urine, and that can lead to very orangey or very pinky urine. A lot of species of animals will have quite turbid urine because there's calcium deposits in it as well. The specific gravity can be very variable, and a lot of our reference ranges have massively variable specific gravities. So these can be hard to interpret. A lot of the pet exotic species that we're looking at, other than ferrets, for example, will have quite alkaline urine because they are predominantly herbivorous, whereas animals that have a more omnivorous or carnivorous diet are likely to have acidic urine. If an animal urinates in the consult room, I will always try and at least get a sample of that and at least do a specific gravity and a dipstick because at base it's a cheap, easy way to assess where my animal is at. If there is a lot of discoloration in the urine, then it might be very difficult to use the dipsticks accurately, simply because pigments can also affect how those are read. But if you have a bright red urine sample, then I would highly recommend doing a SEDI stain and having a look for red blood cells on that. Culture samples. So, in terms of a lot of our species, one of the common things that we get actually are things like abscesses. And I want to just highlight that if we've got an animal with abscesses, sending a culture sample of pus is not always the most useful sample. And with rabbits in particular, but a lot of rodents as well, a lot of the time the pus is in fact sterile. And as soon as you get to bird and reptile abscesses where the pus is solid, then sending a bit of pus for culture can lead to having an incorrectly negative result. So getting a sample that includes part of the abscess capsule or the abscess wall is much more useful. It's a lot more invasive, but it's likely to give you better results. I would also just highlight here that, again, using a lab that is familiar with exotics can be very useful. So, for example, where we're using samples from birds or reptiles, it may be useful to culture these at slightly different temperatures rather than the general sort of 37 to 39 degrees that you would culture a sample for a cat or a dog. And again, the outliers, so those reptiles that perhaps have extremes of temperature and will have a hot spot of 40 to 42 degrees. Those culture samples may need to be done at an elevated temperature in order to grow the things that are relevant for that animal. And to highlight, actually, again, that certainly with things like rabbits, if you culture a normal ear, you will still quite often get quite scary culture results for an animal that actually isn't showing clinical signs. And some animals that are showing very what appear to be very severe clinical signs will end up giving you sterile results. So that can be a little bit of a double-edged sword. And then cytology samples. One of the things that I think I do the least well in practice, and I'm trying to improve, is looking at cytology samples. So, for a lot of the pets that we get in, the first thing that an owner sees on their pet is its skin. And therefore, we're going to likely get a lot of skin cases within the practice. And actually, they're very, very suitable for looking at cytology. You can just, if you have an open wet lesion, get impression smears literally by touching a slide several times to an open lesion. We can do fine needle aspirates on any swellings or lumps. We can spin down samples of bodily fluids. So, if there is an effusion in the chest or an effusion of fluid in the abdomen, spinning down that fluid can be very, very useful. We would generally evaluate these microscopically, but in some cases, with some of these, particularly body fluids, you might also want to compare the specific gravity. You may want to look at the amount of protein in them. And once you have slides, cytology slides prepared, they can be stained with a variety of different stains. In most practices, DiffQuick is what we have access to. But again, if you send the samples out to an external lab, then they have a variety of stains that will enhance different types of cells. And again, that can be useful, quick, relatively cheap, very accessible, and non-invasive for a lot of our exotics patients. And then fecal samples, everybody's favorite. My initiation into clinical practice was actually in North America, and everybody who brings a pet to the vet in North America will bring a fecal sample as standard. And I feel like we do that less commonly here. But again, I would really, really highlight the use of doing this. And we're getting a lot better now at getting our reptile patients in particular to bring in fecal samples quite regularly. And that, there's a variety of things that these can be used for. We can do cultures if we're concerned about Salmonella or Campylobacter. We can do direct smears looking for things like coccidia or parasite eggs. It's more accurate quite often to do a flotation if we're looking for parasites. And the kits for doing fecal flotations are cheap, they're easy to access, they're very easy to set up in-house. It takes about 10 minutes, and you can evaluate them quite accurately on your microscope in your lab. If you are worried about a population or you're worried about a specific type of parasite, you can then send a fecal sample off to the lab to do a quantitative evaluation. And that means looking at literally how many eggs per gram of feces each individual animal has. And that is quite commonly done in populations and quite commonly done in large animal practice. And in many cases, the fresher the sample, the better. But don't discourage owners from bringing a sample in if it isn't, that same day. It can still be quite useful. And a negative sample may not be negative, but if you do find something, then it is likely to be clinically relevant. So, in conclusion, I really hope that you feel able to understand the preparation for samples, the physicality of getting various samples in these exotics patients, and also the range of, very quick and easy samples that we can take and assess in practice to very rapidly make a difference to some of our exotics patients. I would be a little bit, a caveat to sort of serology and just say sometimes it's a good idea to be quite cautious in how you interpret serology. In terms of the fact that actually all that means is exposure, it doesn't mean disease is present. But to just remember that actually, because a lot of these patients are, their behavior is less well known, owners are quite often not very experienced, the habitat is often not ideal, and these animals will often hide their clinical signs so that they're not apparent to the owners, they're not apparent to us on examination or observation. That realistically, clinical pathology needs to be an integral part of diagnosing any small mammal or any exotic patient within our clinical practice. So I've hoped you've enjoyed that, and I hope that I've, as I say, opened your eyes to how easy it is to get samples from these guys.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Molly for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.